What goes on in our mind when we learn a foreign language? Why do we find it so much harder than learning our mother tongue? And what can we do to make the often painful process of learning languages easier? These are just a few of the questions that have long fascinated the Czech psycholinguist Barbara Šmitová. Still in her mid-30s, Barbara has taught and researched at many top European universities and has published extensively in English, German and Dutch, all of which she speaks fluently alongside her native Czech, exploring the pioneering science of psycholinguistics. Put simply, this is the science of what goes on in our head when we are speaking and understanding language. When we met in Prague a few days ago, Barbara told me about the research she is currently carrying out at the University of Heidelberg in Germany, and about her particular interest in second language learning.
A very important part of psycholinguistics is the area of language acquisition, which is my area. And acquisition is actually connected with two lines of research, and this is first and second language acquisition. First language acquisition mainly focuses on how children acquire their first language or first languages. And second language acquisition, which I'm interested in, is how adult speakers acquire a second, third, or another non-mother tongue.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you actually have been working on developing ways of measuring how we think in different languages and in our mother tongue and in languages which we learn. Could you tell us a little bit about the technical side, about how this works, these ways of actually measuring the way that our mind is working when we're using either our mother tongue or a foreign language?
Mm-hmm. Let me stress first that this is a very first research of its kind, and we are using the so-called eye tracking, which is a very good computer which is able to track eye movements, and we're working with this machine at the University of Heidelberg, and this enables us to look into the planning processes that take place immediately before we start speaking.
I was actually used as a guinea pig in one of your experiments. Now, I remember that, for example, you showed the people who took part in the experiments a whole series of short, 30-second videos where you were interested in what we were focusing on as we saw what was happening in the film. The example that you've developed most in your study is the scene where you have a car driving along a road behind some trees around the corner. There are some houses, and you studied how people with different native languages and different second languages responded to that particular image and how they looked, how actually what their eyes looked at and what they said, and you found a correlation between the two things, didn't you?
The idea was to look at these pre-speaking processes and link them to what people prefer to say later in time and also to remember later in time. So this particular scene where a car was indeed depicted driving along a road and in the background there were some houses, there were very clear differences between English, for example, English and German-speaking native speakers, whose attention was completely different. English native speakers...
When you say their attention, you mean actually what they were looking at,
yes.
Which you can measure with the eye tracker.
Precisely, yeah. So the attention is in terms of where they were looking and also for how long were they looking into the particular area. And there was a significant difference between English and, for example, German native speakers, where English preferred to look at the path. So that would be the way along which the car was driving, while German native speakers focused the end point, which was in this particular example, the house. And interestingly, also later in time, so about 10 minutes after the experiment, when the native speakers had to perform a memory test, English native speakers remembered significantly less endpoints than German native speakers. The explanation for this preference in our explanation or in our frame of research is not given by cultural differences, but more by linguistically based language-specific features, which in this specific case are actually based on the presence or absence of the ing marker, which is very productive and very deeply based in the linguistic system of the English language.
You mean like is walking, the ending ing is
precisely,
walking.
Precisely.
Sort of implying a continuity.
And progression. So right now something is the case and it's in the middle of it. So if you want to say it in a more kind of comprehensible terms, you could say that English native speakers have the option to focus and speak about the progression of a situation, while German native speakers don't have the option, and so they have to focus on something else, which is the end point.
So what you're saying is actually something really quite interesting and quite controversial as well, isn't it? Because what you're suggesting is that the way the language works, there's some direct correlation with the way we think, which implies that the old idea that you can say just about anything in any language doesn't really apply, that there are some things that are inherent to certain languages which connect with certain ways of thinking which are reinforced by that language.
Yes, I would be in agreement to about 95%. It's not that you can say everything in any language. The interesting thing is, if you're under pressure, which is the normal thing when you produce language, is what you prefer to say. So if you see a situation that is available to all of us, which components of the situation, which pieces of information will you select naturally in order to describe the situation? And there, language-specific patterns of language production emerge, and there languages differ. So it is true that language does shape the way we think and we actually also perceive a situation, although the world out there is somehow common to us. But if we have to describe something that is out there, language helps us to solve this very difficult task by giving us a certain preferences. And these preferences are indeed, at least according to my point of view, language specific.
This must be something that's very difficult to measure, because to what extent can you exclude the possibility that there's some cultural reason why people who have German as their native language would focus more on endpoints, whereas people who have English as their native language would focus more on the fact that the car is driving at that moment down the road?
We work in about 14 different languages, and they pair not according to the typological or commonly described typological differences, but according to other, let's say, cognitively based patterns. So let me give you an example. For example, English works in this respect similar to Arabic. So Arabic and English, they are very different as the culture background is considered, but they have one common feature, and this is precisely the presence of in the grammar deeply rooted grammatical option to express ongoingness. This would be one example, speaking against culturally based account. And the other one would be that, interestingly, Czech does not pair with the other Slavic languages that we study, for example, Russian or Polish, but it does pair with German. So that shows that German and Czech have in the grammatical system something in common that other Slavic languages apparently lack.
You talk about the use of the eye tracker, which is obviously a very modern innovation, that you can actually measure exactly where the eye is looking when you look at an image. What other possibilities are there for doing these kind of scientific measurements in psycholinguistics?
Well, I was mentioning before the memory tests. So this is how well people remember later on in the study of what they have seen before. This is a very powerful instrument. We found very robust differences between the languages, but colleagues work on other non-linguistic tasks. The most famous would be the categorization task, which means if you look at a group of objects, you categorize them by certain features. And it has been found, for example, by John Lucy, a very famous cognitive linguist from the States, that, for example, Japanese and Yucatec, which is a Mayan language from Central America, and English native speakers categorize objects by different features that are tightly linked to grammatical features in the given system. So if you see three objects and you can categorize them either by form or by shape, English native speakers prefer form over color, while Yucatec or Japanese native speakers do the other way around. So these are really cognitive categories that are persistent even in our linguistic categorization of the world. So that will be an example for yet another technique to study these cognitive preferences.
This is all quite scientific, but are there also practical applications that you can imagine for this kind of research, for example, in language teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for highly motivated and, let's say, talented learners of a second language, this would be a domain that could be really further explored, because we have found, or I have found in my research, that even extremely advanced second language users whose foreign language is nearly native-like still sounds at certain aspects somehow non-native. At least native speakers agree on this. And I think these are exactly these domains that we are investigating. We call it information organization, meaning how do I structure the world around me for language production? And there, the patterns for my mother tongue extremely robust and highly preferred. And I think learners or users of a second language who would be, might be interested in kind of attaining native-like proficiency in the foreign language, might be interested in getting instructions exactly on this domain.
So you think you could actually, if students could become aware of this is how you think in your native language, and this is how people think in the goal language, the language you're trying to learn, that if they could be aware of that difference, that they could actually teach themselves to cross that frontier and actually to speak as natives?
Maybe it's an empirical question, but so far highly motivated and talented learners have not been given the chance.
Is the next step possibly going to be putting nodes on people's heads and measuring which part of the brain is working in when a particular thought process is going on in a particular language? So I know this is a science that's very much at its beginnings. Is that a path that you think that psycholinguistics is going to follow, that you will actually be working out exactly what part of the brain is working when a particular sentence is spoken in a particular language?
These methods, we call them neuroimaging methods, look into the processes that take place in the brain and the localization of these processes in the brain. There lies big future for psycholinguistics in these methods. However, at the current moment, they're quite crude because the differences we've been talking about are extremely subtle and it's hard to detect them in terms of neural processing or neural activities. However, there are first studies that actually show that there are, for example, language-specific differences in processing of colors. So there are first, I would say, pioneer studies in this direction, but we are not quite there yet.
My guest in Checkbooks this week was the psycholinguist Dr. Barbara Shmitova, who has written and researched widely in the fascinating field of language acquisition and currently teaches at the University of Heidelberg.